Services and Systems here at King's College London, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this joint ISS-IPNet seminar on web futures and the implications for higher education. I have to say, this is a brilliant turnout. I'm absolutely delighted to see so many people, not only from within King's College London, but from many partner institutions around London. You're all very welcome here, and it's a great tribute to Susan Farrell and her colleagues in the web team and in IPNet for putting together such an impressive event and inviting so many of you, so welcome. I know you're going to enjoy today because we've got the world expert, I think, Brian Kelly here, who is our guest speaker from UConn, and many of you will know UConn, which is a national center of expertise in digital information management, and it's located at the University of Bath. Now, King's has had a lot of contact with UConn over the years. In fact, Brian reminded us that he actually came to speak here in 1994 and helped launch one of the first web seminars for NHG here later in 1997. And we've had links through one of my predecessors, Derek Law, with UConn, and also I've had links with UConn through the Library and Information Commission. So UConn and King's go back a long way, and we're just delighted that Brian is back to talk to us today. Now, his title is really interesting. He's the UK Web Focus. And his job is to be the National Web Coordinator and Advisor to the higher and further education sectors and the cultural heritage sectors on best practices related to the web. And his post is funded by JISC, which is the Joint Information Systems Committee, and MLA, which is the Museums, Libraries, and Archives Council. So very significant high-level national funding. Supporting Brian. And some of you I know Brian from the past, and you know that he's always been and is still in the vanguard of involvement with the web. And he have helped to establish one of the first web services in UK higher education at the University of Leeds. In fact, I think it was probably the first institutional web service and was one of the first 50 organizations around the world to register a web service, so right at the beginning. And he's continued, of course, to be an authority on web and web futures, and has written over 200 publications and given hundreds of 200 presentations and hundreds of publications on all aspects of the web and technologies. And one of the things we noted, Susan told me, was that you gave a similar title presentation in 1998, so we want to know how things have changed in the last 8 years. But one thing that might have changed is that we really are in the vanguard of high tech today, because I think you're letting some people listen in through Skype, and we're going to do a podcast, and we're also having this video, and this will be on our website later today. So all sorts of technology, making sure that this is a very open access lecture. Brian is also masterminded the development of the most successful annual Institutional Web Managers Conference, again, which I think began here at King's in 1997. So we are truly looking forward to hearing what you have to say and seeing what you're going to show us. Welcome to King's.
Thank you. How did you follow that introduction? But just to correct one point, I'm not a world's leading expert. I was probably one of the UK's leading experts for about a month or so in early 1993, but now all those clever young geeks are well ahead of me. So I tend to got a broad view rather than a specific details view. But thanks for that introduction. A couple of things before I start. This talk is being videoed, and the video will be made available. And I'm also recording the talk for myself. We have a bit of backup. I did intend to use Skype so that we could have a remote participant listening in, and also with the webcam viewing, but he hasn't turned up, so I've switched that off now because I don't want to start to ring. That's off. So we won't be actually using the Skype today. The slides are all available on the web at this website. And I kind of thought, when Susan told me that there was over 100 people at booth and it was going to be a large lecture theatre, I was thinking, well, it'll be Wi-Fi networks everywhere. Everyone will be bringing the laptops and the like. So I spoke to Susan yesterday, and she goes, oh, we've got a slight hiccup. We've discovered that the room doesn't actually have a network connection. So thanks to Susan's colleagues for setting up the putting it in place. But I'm afraid I'm the only person with a network connection at the moment. So you won't be able to, you know, have real-time chats, download the slides, etc. now. But all of these slides are available. And anything that is an obvious link, when you go to these slides, you can click on and follow further information. So you can't use the network connections, but you do have permission if you have, you know, mobile phones with recording capabilities, digital cameras, iPods, whatever, and you want to make your own talk, that's fine. You have permission to do that, subject to me giving consent at the end of the talk. By this, I mean, if I inadvertently say something libelous, if I out another member of the Liberal Democratic Party, I'd ask you not to make that available. The other caveat I would say is, if you are using any technologies, use them to support the aims of this event, and not just to read your email, and try not to be distracting to other people. So that's the AUP. In a way, it's a bit of a theoretical AUP, because nobody seems to have the cameras out and the laptops out. But I'm kind of making a point. We can do all these things today, and our students will be doing all these things today. So we need to think about some of the human issues, the dangers. I've not yet started to talk about technologies, but I have say need for things like an acceptable use policy and perhaps a pragmatic approach. Rather than the big signs on the wall which says switch off all mobile phones when entering this room, perhaps we have a more pragmatic approach which can take on board the potential of such devices. The slides are available, and the subsequent talk will be available under a Creative Commons license. I do make a caveat that some of these things I don't actually own the copyright to, so I don't own the copyright of the MLA logo. As a pragmatic approach, it should be obvious the stuff that I created and the stuff that's somebody else's image or logo. Okay, so to move on. Bit of an introduction, well, prepared a lot of the introduction. A bit of background. I think it would be useful to put these things into some context, and I think having been a web geek since 1993, that's about 13 years. And they used to say that a web year was the equivalent of 7 human years. So I should have received a telegram from the Queen. So kind of look where we are now, and then look at some of the futures, some of the exciting things that are happening, some of the things that are happening within W3C. And it used to be that we always looked at W3C. But in a way, things are happening outside of W3C. And then I'll touch on, probably won't have much time, to talk about some of the deployment challenges. I should say that in a way, what I'll be looking to do is to look at some of the potential for some of these new developments. But there'll be a whole set of issues, so I won't necessarily be giving a balanced view of some of these issues. You can always say, yeah, but. I mean, we say that all the time in the Southwest, yeah, but, no, but, yeah. And that's really what we're about. There are issues, you know, things we need to think about. Look at the other side of things, maybe refine our discussions. I think it's really important that we have this debate, we have this wide debate. Okay, well, you've heard all of those things. Back in 1994, when I came to places like King's, it was because I thought the web was great, and people were saying, no, Brian, the future is Gopher. How many people have used Gopher, remember Gopher? Okay, it's kind of interesting. It's about a third of the audience, so 2/3 of people can't remember that. That was an exciting new technology in the early part of 1992. I've also attended several of the international web conferences, and I was pleased to say that just yesterday I heard that I had a paper accepted for an accessibility conference, which would be held the day before the web conference, which is in Edinburgh this year. So that's a bit about me. History of the web. Okay, 1993, we had the early adopters. And when did the web win? 94, 95, within the university sector. It was probably around that time when the Gopher crowd sort of started to keep quiet and realise that, you know, to move on. And then we think it was 1994. I don't know if people know David Riddle, Max Supporters List from Goldsmiths College. He set up and is the list owner of the web support list. And I was trying to work out, when did the web support list start? And what were we talking about back then? We don't know. The archives have gone. Not only have the archives gone from the mail-based site, there is no evidence that the list ever existed. So there's a bit of a danger. You'll know this. Archives management, you know, digital preservation, records management. We don't know, you know, when the list was set up and what we were talking about back then. But we kind of think, David and I think, it was sometime around 1994. And that was when there was a whole group of enthusiasts. We were all working together. We were all trying to transform society. You know, it was a really great, exciting time. I think, in a way, if you're a Labour Party supporter, it was probably like 1997. You know, you could only see, you know, good things happening. And then, of course, things changed. You can edit that one out for and then, perhaps 2 years later, we moved on from the enthusiasts, the techies, in various departments to, well, we're setting up our university web service, and it's kind of not techie issues anymore, it's political issues, it's resourcing issues, it's, you know, change, cultural change, organisational change. So a couple of people around, I used to keep a list of when there were, of jobs that were advertised for university web managers, but I threw some of those away. So I've lost a record of the first proper university web managers post. I don't know if anyone thinks it's there. But initially it was the enthusiasts, and then they kind of discovered, people were coming up to me and saying, Brian, I thought this would be a really cool job, but I'm actually being used as a political pawn in power struggles between the MIS departments, the computing service and the library. And they're not the worst, it's the academics, they're the real worst. So we started to realise it was more than the technical side of things. And we started to develop a community. We've got a strong community there. Back in 1994, 95, there are some best practices documents. I wrote one on running an institutional web service, and that is still available on the Advisory Group of Computer Graphics website. It's kind of interesting looking at that, because you can see my enthusiasm for a wonderful new browser called Netscape. So there's some issue there. And then, as we heard, the first institutional web management workshop was held here at King's on a very hot June day when there was building works going on. Were you there, Jeremy? Yeah, do you remember all of terrible? Oh, sorry, didn't say it was terrible. Edit that one out. So we've been running ever since, and this year it's a bath, it's the 10th anniversary, and so we wondered initially, it was lunchtime to lunchtime, whether we'd have enough content to talk about, and quite clearly we did, and we extended. So back then, it was all about meeting people. It was kind of it was therapy for people, that these political pawns. Then it was networking, and it was making contacts and written contacts and realising not a line. And initially it was finding answers from the gurus, but we don't have gurus anymore. The first one we were talking about, there was a talk from Ukerna. Caches were important, and having images on your website was a bad thing. You can actually go through and look at some of the slides and the discussions. And it was all about authoring tools and HTML, putting your databases on the web. Those were the talks at the first event. And then over the years, we discovered, and I think it was Stephen Emmett. Is Stephen around? Hi there. I think Stephen Emmett was the first person at one of the Institutional Web Managers workshop to use the CMS acronym. So Stephen was saying, content management systems, we really need these to support our institution. And then other people came along. It was probably Andrew Erd, I think, who used to be Director of Web Services here at that time, was at Goldsmiths, said, no, Brian, we don't need a CMS. We need a web strategy. So just have a web strategy, and then everything will be wonderful. Or perhaps web strategy plus CMS equals we solve all our institutional problems. So they're the type of things that we talk about in these events. And we also talk about new technologies, but it tends to be about new technologies to support our corporate aims rather than, you know, just the new stuff in isolation. So they're the type of things we talk about. But we now know there are no easy answers. There's probably no universal answers. We do need to provide solutions which reflect our corporate culture or institutional culture. And I think we've moved away from the gurus to the learning from everybody. So to use a computing analogy, from a server client mode to a peer-to-peer mode. And it is quite interesting, at these events we tend to, I think, was it about 24 parallel sessions was held at the last event, and 30 I think the day before. So we have, you know, lots of people who can contribute in different ways to building up that community. And I think we're doing well. You know, there's all of that sharing, there's all those sharing going on web support and website info management lists. You know, somebody says, I'm trying to do this, got this new website, and I've got this you know, slight problem, can anybody help? And somebody comes with an answer, and somebody comes in with an even better answer, and then Patrick Lauka from University of Salford comes out with the best answer of all. You know, he's actually speaking at the App Media Conference. He's an international guru, and he, you know, helps share for free. I don't think the people who are in the banking sector have that culture of sharing. And I think it reflects the HE culture, the sharing culture, the exploiting the network technologies that we have, the going to conferences and talking at conferences. We have a web of well-established annual events. And I think we've been successful in avoiding the ghetto mentality, because we have, you know, the senior managers, the librarians, the information professionals, the designers, the techies, the trainers. You know, they meet, they talk, and they get drunk. They socialise together. And it was interesting, a couple of months ago, a colleague at Bath Computing Service was saying that some of the people in his department went to two separate events. One was an e-learning event, and they came back and says, oh yes, the future is Skype. We can have these, you know, people talking, you know, it's easy to use, it's easy to set up. This is really great. We must really support and deploy this. And another colleague went to a network systems group, and they came back and says, this Skype, it's really evil. It's stealing our bandwidth. We must ban it. And so you've got that danger about the, you know, those people not necessarily talking to each other. I think we have avoided that at the web managers event. But we do have arguments. Yeah, we do have the open source versus licensed software debate. Healthy debate. Doesn't everybody? We have the issues about standards versus proprietary stuff, you know, and I say lots of things about standards, and look, I'm using PowerPoint here. And then we have the general issue about the managing with limited resources. But one of the bigger issues was the tensions, I think, between managing a service which can implement best practices and supporting the disparate needs of the user community. And I think a great exemplar of that was Andrew Erd's talk in 2002 on pursuing a radical web strategy. And Andrew was really saying the web is mission critical to our institutions, and we do need to manage that and to control that, just like we have a managed view of our payroll system that I suspect we're all happy with. The web service is similarly mission critical, and it shouldn't be, you know, people playing and trying new toys and doing things in different ways. We really do need to have that managed approach. And Andrew's, I think, radical solution was to have a search and destroy approach to people who had Dreamweaver on the desktop and weren't using the content management system. That was slightly tongue-in-cheek, and it generated a lot of debate. And Andrew also was awarded the Spurtle, which is a Scottish name for a wooden spoon, for the most controversial talk at the event. But it was kind of interesting, because throughout the rest of the event, our techies were saying similar things, that, well, if only everybody was using XML, or, you know, the accessibility people, we need a tool to manage the accessibility. And we were all kind of saying a similar thing. So I think back then, it was the need to have a standardised strategy to facilitate the publishing process. So that was the web back then. But I would argue that might have been relevant back then, but times have changed, and we need to revisit our culture in how we approach the development of web services. So that's some of the things about our community. Web standards, well, HTML plus a bit of CSS plus a bit of Web Accessibility Initiative is things that we should be doing, and everyone really bought into that, and there was a bit of a problem with Netscape, but there was no real tensions in the early days. Then later on, XML came along, and XML is good, you know, full stop. Then there were various new W3C formats. I don't know if anybody is actually using in a systematic, you know, large-scale use of ping. Oh, anyone? Show of hand. Oh, one. Smile. Okay, smile. That wasn't a command, by the way. That was synchronized multimedia interchange language. Scalable vector graphics. these are really old technologies, and they haven't yet limited takeoff. How many people are developing applications in Flash? Okay, a couple more. So we've seen that some of the technologies developed by W3C a long time ago haven't yet sort of had widespread take-up. And more recently, complexity and confusion. Semantic web. How many people are developing semantic web applications? How many people know of anybody who's developing semantic web applications? Two people. Okay, kind of, maybe. So at the web conference last year, which was held in Japan, there were two sessions that were quite interesting. One was web services considered harmful. So web services, you know, a series of standards such as SOAP and UDDI and WSDL developed by W3C. And there was a panel session with lots of people there. And the person who organized the panel was saying, if you print off all the web services specifications, it comes to over 1,000 pages. And nobody understands it all. And it's far too complex. Maybe we should be thinking, do we need that complexity and perhaps go back to the simplicity of the initial web? And there were similar issues about the semantic web, but again, hasn't really taken off. But then we have the difficulties of deploying anything new. It's a bit like, how would we change from driving on the left to driving on the right in this country? Well, we can't because of the difficulties in a transition. And how will we move to XHTML 2.0, which is not backwards compatible? It's going to be difficult. And there was a whole series of discussions within W3C about patents and process issues and, you know, the inevitable thing, you know, you get the complexity, you get the tensions and the like. So I think recently we were seeing that the web was getting a bit boring. And perhaps that's fine. Perhaps that was a reflection of the maturity. You know, perhaps at some stage MIS people were excited about the payroll systems and the new payroll systems, but now it's just a job. So one could argue that it's now mature, we're doing a job, and these things won't happen. That's one view. So we kind of know the web is mission critical, and I think the web team are mission critical. I kind of wondered, well, imagine if there was an AUT dispute and the web team that downed authoring tools. It's mission critical. But we now, our organisations do have web teams, we do have budgets, you know, we do have resources. Not as much as we want, but every department's going to say that. We typically have a web strategy or an IT strategy or, you know, whatever. But I would argue that, having looked at a couple, the focus tends to be on what one might class as a web 1.0 view of the world. And we know some of the key application areas within our organisations. There's the institutional website, there are the intranets, there are the virtual learning environments, and portals and digital repositories. I think they're some of the main... Any other important web application area I'm missing there? So I think they're the main ones. So that's where we are today. And we kind of want to know what we should be doing with these things. And, you know, we at the Web Managers Workshop, we hear examples of best practices and people doing things. Jeremy spoke, gave a keynote last year about the work he was doing integrating various back-end systems. So it was kind of this incremental and, yeah, we try things different. But I think things are changing, and I think it's really over the past year or so we're seeing some big changes in terms of the web out there, and these things are starting to filter through into our sector. But we know it's happening, but we don't really know if it's a good thing or a bad thing or not. So we've got blogs and wikis and RSS and podcasting. And we've got all of these mobile devices, which can mostly fit in my pocket, except for that would be a bit embarrassing. And then we have the pervasive networks. We have the Wi-Fi in many places, but not necessarily pervasive everywhere. We have broadband at home. And we have this thing about all of these mobile phones and 3G technologies and Sky News on demand and, you know, all of that type of thing, which kids are arriving with. You know, our kids are using all the time. How does that fit in with this bigger picture? And we're seeing these integration of services, integration of data, integration of are public sector type services and services provided by the commercial world. Anybody heard of Google? People read in yesterday's Guardian? There was a 6-page article about Google, whether it was a good thing or an evil thing. You know, so we have these things. We have things like micro formats and folksonomies. We have all those Google developments. We have SOA. Anybody recognise this 3-letter acronym? Nope. Service-oriented architecture. So a new approach to development. And these type of things are nowadays being labelled as Web 2.0. So it's a marketing term rather than a formal technical standard. And I think that's okay, you know, it's classed as an attitude rather than a technology. So characteristics, the network as a platform, participation, social networking, social tagging, mashups, syndication, a focus on user-generated content. There's also this thing about always better. You know, things are always changing, you know, so we're in a lot more dynamic world rather than here's the corporate CMS system and we've got a roadmap provided by the vendor. We're in an always beta environment. And the exemplars, you know, the ones you'll know about, you know, Amazons and Googles and Delicious and Bloggers and Flickr's for sharing photos with some folksonomies and Wikipedia. And interestingly, BitTorrent and that whole issue about where does peer-to-peer technologies fit in with what with things we're doing. And communities such as eBay, which is a community, and it's kind of interesting because recently they bought Skype because they knew that, you know, for having those people to buy things. So let's look at some examples. Now the examples I'm going to give are slides that was taken from a presentation given by my director, Liz Lyon, at a masterclass for senior managers in the Southwest region. So the museums, libraries and archives, senior managers. And I think it's kind of interesting, the things that Liz was saying to them and the things that they're interested in. So Google Maps. The examples that I repurposed from Liz are all based on the Southwest, so you won't know where Ilminster, UK is. So we've got a campus map, and you see those things on the left, zooming in and out, and you zoom in and out, and it zooms in and out straight away. And the reason it does that, it's using a technology called AJAX, which stands for Asynchronous Java and XML. So asynchronous JavaScript means that it's happening while you're thinking. So it's not waiting for you to press the submit button and it go away and do things. It's managing things. Yeah?
Sorry, I couldn't stop pointing out Google Map on the website for this event today.
Yes, I was just about to move on to that. Good point. I'm glad you mentioned that. XML web services. So when I was coming here last night, I hope you don't mind me saying this, because it's true of all universities. So I rang up Susan and said, "Where am I?" And I printed off the page. So this is the map I got when I printed off from Firefox. And I thought, oh, that's a bit embarrassing, but I know how to right-click on View Image. So I printed off the GIF. So we have, it's one of the grey buildings, but I can't differentiate between the key here and the building there. And I was doing all of this when I was doing things, but I thought, well, that's not a problem, because I said to Susan, what's the postcode of this place? So Susan gave me the postcode, and I updated that thing. And so when I got off at London Bridge, I got off and I went down here, whereas we're actually here. So I thought, hang on a moment, and your porters are really friendly. I went into the wrong building. He actually took me over here, showed me the way. Really nice guy. Round of applause for the porters. But what do we get from this? So this is better, but it was either the postcode was wrong, metadata was wrong, or the postcode, this is the middle of that postcode area. So we actually need the postcode plus one of the buildings here. Now, I didn't know where I was going to, so I couldn't provide that, but that's an issue, I think, for the service provider to do these things. So yeah, we need to do these things, but one of the interesting things is, oh yes, we know that it's on our list of things to do soon. It doesn't have to be a big thing, because from an attitude point of view, in a Web 1.0 world, the attitude was we had to manage all our own data. Now we're saying, we don't, we can use Google. You know, Google is going to be around. You might not be 100% happy. You might say, we can't use Google because it's centering information in China. But do we need to apply that, those political considerations? In a mixed economy, we might say, yeah, we just link to Google and we can do better. So I'm glad you mentioned that point because I was going to as well. And I learned, because I hadn't twigged, that London is so big and there's so many different buildings around. And that's kind of interesting because it's different in the Southwest. So this is a Google Earth view of the Southwest. What do you notice about it? It's very green, isn't it? Yeah, so that's Taunton, and, you know, little hamlets and, you know, nice, you know, scenery and the like. So, and we've been doing things like using Google Earth to have a fly-through of, you know, various events, like all of those web managers events. And we can, you know, integrate it, we can do searching and the like. So these things you can just do. We can all do. So Google Earth, so we have a service. So that is going to Google and using that service. So one of the interesting things are the mashups. So if you go to the BBC website, backstage, bbc.co.uk, you'll see some examples of integrating various services and using XML feeds from X, Y, and Z. I mentioned GreaseMonkey is kind of an interesting thing for doing some of these things, but no time to talk about those things. And here, this is an example supported by Backstage where we've got Google Map plus some travel information provided by the BBC, which is overlaid. And you'll be pleased you'll notice that we suffer from traffic delays in the southwest as well. There was a bit of roadworks on the high street in Taunton, but everywhere else is fine. So these are the type of things that we could do. Now, I was talking, myself and Liz were talking at a Common Information Environment meeting in London 2 days ago. I met somebody from the BBC. It was about this. And there are competitions. BBC Backstage have competitions. Free iPod for the best examples in different areas. And I suggested that how about doing something Backstage mashup in education or in higher education? And he goes, oh yeah, that'll be good. So the prize is a free iPod. So if we agree on this, I'm hoping at the next Institutional Web Managers Workshop we might announce this. But you've got a head start, and those of you listening on the podcast, if we manage to progress this. So we might like to think about what can we do? You know, the whole mapping side of things is just a no-brainer, I would say. We just do those things. But whether we could do something a bit more innovative, and particularly some of the things that you might want to do within London, across the London colleges. You know, I know there's close links between the web teams within London. Are there ways in which you can work to integrate your disparate data sources together in some innovative ways?
I think one of the problems I've had when I was looking at Google Earth and some of the overlays for London is that so many independents have just submitted things for institutions, I mean, that you end up with five UCLs and three Kings, and they're not quite the same. You're never sure which is the official one because people just contribute. So actually getting an official layer
that's
a bit more of a trick.
Yeah, well, that's kind of interesting, is it? So we need this managed approach to submitting, you know, venues and the dangers? Because it seems to me then we're revisiting, you know, every department setting up their own website. But it's not about information that we manage, it's information that we provide to external sources. And how do you say, the head of department in computing science that they should stop registering their own sort of department? So there's some interesting issues there. Okay, we've got all of the mobile devices issues as well. And podcasting, look, there's a guy, dentistry students, whatever, holding his iPod in which he records lectures. He proposed to his professors that they do this. You know, so kind of interesting. The student told his professors about this new technology and what they should be doing with it. Talis, a library vendor based in Birmingham, have been publishing podcasts and blogs about their vision for the world, and also UConn and our e-learning units have also been experimenting with some of these things. So again, you can do this. You can record, students can record their lectures, share those lectures with other people, with their mates. So it's no longer a I slept in, kind of, can you lend me your notes? It's, can you let me, you know, beam me for talks? So a whole set of issues, but one of the points being, it's low effort to do this. It's high effort to do it well. And there's lots of issues, copyright, etc., etc. But people are doing it. There's also, now, if we move on to the next slide, again, hey, the Victoria and Albert Museum is ahead of the game. So corporately, they seem to, they've got this nice website which says, visits first podcast to be published by a museum or gallery. And they said, subscribe via iTunes. So if you've got something good that, you know, that you're saying, should we be, you know, your lecturers, your keynote talks, you know, your distinguished visitors, or the Vice Chancellor saying what a great institution it is, or, you know, all of those things, should you be publishing it on iTunes? You can. Now, this is going back to the mixed economy, but iTunes is pretty popular with a lot of people. So, again, it's perhaps an attitude issue. Oh, and by the way, 6 months ago when I was doing searches for examples of UK podcasts, it was all Students' Union radio shows. No e-learning there. Students are ahead of the game. Part of this attitude, there's examples of some technological areas. Another part of this development is the content issue. So we have Creative Commons, Science Commons. Anybody received any email from Stephen Harnett? Yes, a couple of people get that joke. Who was a passionate promoter of open access. Open source. These are the type of things that are helping to drive Web 2.0. And this is where we need to think about the material that's our copyright. Do we protect that copyright, or do we manage that copyright by saying, well, it's our copyright, and the rights we give, or other people can use the stuff, say, through use such as Creative Commons. Creative Commons. And I gave a paper at UNIS conference in Manchester last year, arguing that in terms of scientific data, that's somebody else's problem. The open access of research publications, you know, that's a big issue for many of the content people and Stephen Harnett and the like. But IT support material, to me, that's a no-brainer. I used to be an information officer and wrote training documents in, you know, IT applications. And these days I was thinking, well, if I was doing that, I'd make that available under Creative Commons. And I was thinking, well, if I'm at the University of Bath, you know, that's, you know, five-star in some respects, and it's got all of that research interest. But the support issue is not a big issue in terms of, you know, the institutional politics. So let's say this is University of Bath stuff, and if people around the world start to use it to take it up, then that's free advertising for us. So it's not, you know, a hippie view of, you know, the openness. There can be legitimate business reasons that you can maximise your impact by putting things out there rather than, oh, well, maybe we could sell it. You know, is that a reality? Flickr. Flickr and taxonomies, you know, user-created tags. So something we were doing, been doing at a couple of events, is saying when people are using blogs, taking photos, let's agree on a tag to make things easy to find. So when it's your graduation day and you've got all of those proud parents taking photos, and we used to, you know, oh, can you send us a copy of that and swap addresses, and nobody ever did because it was such a pain. It's now easy. The discovery side of things can be difficult. So why not sort of say, you know, in graduation 2006, and just encourage people to do that, you know. And it was kind of interesting, Jeremy was there at the Institutional Web Management Workshop on the 7th of July, when there was a group of us on the laptops and we heard news of the London bombings, and we couldn't get through to the BBC website. And then somebody says, oh, just go to Flickr. So we were getting, well, you click on this and it's still there, that there was a kind of community agreement on a set of tags. So this is user agreements, user ways of doing things to help users, and it's ways in which we can do support this. So proactively making your photos available, such as Cornell University seem to be doing there. Confuse things. We have the semantic web and we have the semantic web, or often written down as semantic web and lowercase semantic web. So the semantic web was Tim Berners-Lee's and his colleagues in W3C for developing a web with meaning, etc., etc. And if you go through the semantic web pages on W3C, it won't be very long before you start running away screaming because it's difficult to understand. It's hard. It's trying to solve very difficult problems. The lowercase semantic web was a group of the standards guys, such as Eric Meyer, who's one of the stylesheet guys, saying, well, we're bored with waiting. Can't we see what we can do with things that we can do today? So microformat was really saying, let's provide a bit of semantics in existing HTML structures. So I can do span class equals vcard, and then span first name class equals first name and surname. Agreed on the standard, agreed conventions for them. And those can be transformed. So you can click on my name on a web page, and up pops a add Brian Kelly's detail to your Outlook calendar or, you know, whatever application you have. Those things can kind of be done today. So various examples there. Right, I'll move quickly on. We know about blogs, and we know about the difficulties of blogs, but we know of the benefits. Similarly, wikis. Anybody provide a core institutional wiki service? Kind of. Okay. Where are you at?
London Metropolitan,
ahead of the game. What about corporate institutional blog service? Okay, Warwick University is doing this, and there's a podcast interview with John Dale about that and the reasons why. That reminds me I need to talk a lot more quickly. But wikis, go to Wikipedia, look at your institution. There'll probably be some pages about your institution and Wikipedia. I think all UK universities, I suspected, are covered. And it's the students who are there. So I would argue that if you've got an interest in the PR and marketing of your department, you might want to be able to take a proactive role to content there. And it's something I've been doing. My contributions to Wikipedia are the pages on rapper sword dancing. So rapper sword dancing is not Morris dancing, it's not Cotswold Morris dancing, it's from the northeast of England. And I was worried that the southern Cotswold Morris dancers would give their view of our tradition. So I created a page which says it's from the northeast and had a map in the northeast and defined the structure. So it'd be difficult. I've laid a claim. Well, I wasn't so that concerned about the southern Cotswold dancers, it was more the American Cotswold dancers, to be honest. But I staked a claim to that. And then people can tweak that, or it becomes difficult to make substantial changes. So similarly with the pages on Wikipedia about London Metropolitan University. Oh, and by the way, the students who put that information there probably won't care when you get the new Vice-Chancellor, but there's some factual information that you might want to think about. I'll skip over messaging. Anybody ban instant messaging? You don't have to raise your hand in case you're feeling embarrassed, but some places do. But by the way, if you go to Mevo.com, you've got this is a web-based instant messaging client to MSN, Jabber, AOL, Yahoo, which is an Ajax implementation. So here's an example. Here's my buddy list, and here's somebody talking to me. Sending me a proprietary nudge, which doesn't work in this, but we can chat. So if you're trying to ban instant messaging because it's just trivial chat and you've disabled the ports, well, there are ways around it. So you've got this issue about how do you ban something which is easy to get around, and should you? The other interesting thing is, this is a web application. Is it publishing? So the metaphor of the web as a publishing vehicle is kind of breaking down, because now we're talking about web applications and how does a web strategy apply to applications? How does it apply to your policies on accessibility? What should happen when you press the back button? So if you're in, you know, an arbitrary application, you're in MS Word, what happens when you press the back button? The concept doesn't really work because we're familiar with a page-turning metaphor based on information. So some of those things that we hold dearly kind of break down in this type of application world. I'll skip over Gmail. Similarly, we've got Skype, and that's Laurie, who's not there for some reason. But again, people are starting to use, and there's a need to be. So is this something that is in the web world? Or is that just, that's an application that IT services have to manage that? Well, there are increasingly overlaps with the web world. So on your web pages, you can have a page which says, I'm currently online on your web page. You know, and that's linking to your desktop. So there are those kind of interesting links. But you know, some of the other things are, as well as the issues about that particular application, how does it change the dynamics of what we're doing? So you can come along, industrial espionage. You can go along into that senior meeting with your pocket PC, with your microphone, and you can have people listening in. And we know that. But those other people who aren't here don't know that. So some kind of interesting issues there about not only exploiting the potential in beneficial ways, but managing some of those difficulties. I'll skip over RSS because RSS is great and you should just use it. You know, you should just do it. And you can follow the links there to various other talks. And there's a podcast. My first podcast was all about why RSS is just a no-brainer. You know, it doesn't matter what it stands for. You just do it. We can talk afterwards about some of those things, but I've got about 5 slides to do in minus 3 minutes. So give me a... So there's some interesting things, and I've kind of given you a superficial overview of those things, and you're going to say, yes, but you've forgotten about X, Y, and Z. No, I haven't forgotten about them. I haven't had time to do them. So how do we go about deploying these things is one question. The more important question is, well, should we? Isn't it hype? Yeah, might be hype, you know. Well, it might be something that is relevant. There might be bits that are relevant. It might be, oh yeah, it's all well and good, but that's commercial stuff. You know, we need to focus in our, our own particular issues, and we can leave, you know, those use of Skypes and things to a separate world. So some of the challenges, it might be that if within our institution, the web policy and the web culture is owned by the marketing people. And, you know, they insist on putting a logo in a particular place everywhere. And once you start telling them about RSS so that people can have a mashup that your data can be in somebody else's page, oh, and without the logo, that they sort of run away, start screaming because they don't like that approach, or they see it as a publishing vehicle and not a communications tool. And if that's the corporate view, and that's the thing that gets funding, is there going to be a sort of slowness in the communications aspect? There might be the issues that we can't use Creative Commons, open access, for various reasons, ... Well, there's some of the debates that you need to have. I mean, there's the Just from the DOSWatch service, which is a neutral and biased, and they're not the sort of, they'll give an informed view about how the relevance of these type of approaches within our institutions. Or you might say that these type of services are technically flawed or philosophically flawed. Some librarians get really hate folks' enemies. Mind you, some librarians in the 1990s really hated the web. I can remember some senior ones. I'll save that for my memoirs. Or we might have personal views on, well, we can't use X because everything must be open source, or everything must be open standard, or, you know, everything must comply with WAI guidelines. So there's a whole set of issues there, legitimate issues. I'm not saying the issues are wrong. I'm saying we need to have a wider debate. And we need to perhaps change our culture. Some people say that these are disruptive technologies. Others say, no, universities are really good at evolving and just absorbing things that were initially perceived as disruptive technologies and just mainstreaming them. And that's probably right, but in that process it can be a bit painful. So I think the mainstreaming of the institutional web was kind of painful for some of those early adopters. Those things should have popped up. Sorry. So what are the answers to all of those questions? Can you pretend you don't see all those things? How do we face the challenges? My answer was going to be, well, if you sign up for the Initiatives and Innovation Managing Disruptive Technologies Day's event, we'll be trying to address some of those challenges. And there's also the Web Managers Workshop, and I've got some flyers of the call for papers and workshops, in which
it might be provide an opportunity for you to engage in debate, to talk about some of the interesting things that you might be involved in, you know, within your institutions. Answers for free. So you don't necessarily have to go to that event. The need to be agile organisations. And I was reading in the legal column of The Guardian on Monday, in which the guy was saying, I think it's in my bag, who owns the London Whale? Has this been in all the London papers? Apparently it's the Queen. It's officially called a royal fish, even though we know the fish is a mammal. So it's a bit like a swan. But the organisation that went out to try and rescue the male was the British something or other, which was a volunteer organisation. So they were being adaptable and saying, couldn't possibly do that because it's the Queen's problem. You know, they were doing that. And similarly, you know, so maybe the monarchy, is the monarchy more adaptable than our institution? No, we should be adaptable. And in a way, we can say, we can do the excitement, there's this Web 2.0 stuff coming along, and you can try and motivate people by saying, it's this exciting thing. But in reality, it's not new, because we've been doing it. Do you remember the hybrid libraries, ELIB hybrid libraries, Agora, M25 link, etc., etc.? They were providing searching of library catalogues within the institutions, within other institutions, at the British Library and some of the JISC services. Guess what? That was a mashup. But it wasn't sexy, because it was kind of Z3950, and, you know. But we were doing it. And similarly, the RDN has behind the headlines, where it's taking relevant information from BBC feeds. So we've been doing that. So maybe it's not such a, you know, radical thing after all. And I think particularly, I would argue, in our HE environments, where we have the diversities. So we have the diversity, just point of view is probably all these universities, they're all different. Yeah, you know, and Hefke will say the same thing. And you will know within your organisation that you're disparate as well. So different departments will have different things, and it can be difficult for a vice chancellor to try and, you know, change things across the institution. So there is a need to have that modularity to reflect that diversity rather than to mandate conformance with a particular view. And there might be things like the GIST e-framework and its service-oriented approach, which seeks to develop things in little modules. So you can change the little modules rather than have to change a bigger thing. So moving away from our corporate CMS or our corporate VLE, and it can be different to make the little module changes. You know, the GIST vision is to provide some more flexibility to take on board new technologies, new ways of working, you know, rather than the monolithic approach. And if you sign up for that, that's great. If you don't, what's the scary things? Well, your rivals will. London Metropolitan University are ahead of the game. So, or if you work in central services, your departments are going to do these things anyway. And then your vice chancellor will say, why do we need these central services when people in departments are doing better stuff in any case? But we can also outsource to Google and Yahoo. Why do we provide a central email service when I can get 1 gig with a really good search interface from Gmail? Okay, that's a rhetorical question. Don't have to answer that. So I'll stop there. Sorry for that. Thank you.
As always, Brian, you're giving us lots to think about, some great ideas. I'm thinking immediately the mashups across the University of London. Wouldn't it be great for central room booking to know where all the spaces were across the whole of the London colleges? Brian's very kindly said he will stay for as long as we want, really, to have questions and discussion. We're suggesting that we perhaps give ourselves another 20 minutes. So I'm looking for the first question or comment from the audience for Brian. Come on, don't be shy.
Colleague at back. I'm particularly interested in this way in Ajax and Web 2 development. So we've already started to adapt it. I fear the thing that's going to kill it off our attempts to use it in a serious way would be accessibility, which It occurs to me that from a technical point of view, a lot of the Web 2 approaches might actually make building accessibility type software easier, but I fear that the sort of approach to providing guarantees of accessibility is firmly rooted in the partnership model that you just described earlier. But I don't know if you had any sort of thoughts.
Yes. I'm glad you asked me that question as well. As I was saying, because I found out yesterday I had a paper accepted at a web accessibility conference up in Edinburgh, which builds on a previous award-winning paper, which was about accessibility of e-learning. It was given at the OLT conference, and another paper in Japan last year, in which, so this is work being which has been carried out by mainly myself, Laurie Phipps, who was formerly at TechDisk and January moved to JISC, Helen Petrie, who used to be a professor at City University and has now moved to York University, and a couple of other people. And one of the things we looked at, so about 2 years ago, when was it? It was when 2002, wasn't it? It was when Sender legislation became law. I ran Bobby across 164 university websites. How many do you think complied with WAE AA?
Three.
It was four, but it was really three, because one of them was all generated by JavaScript. And so the notion of accessibility was a bit of a no-brainer, because everybody has signed up to that. The implementation was flawed. And when I revealed this, I said, well, it's either because you're all a bunch of nasty right-wing fetcherites who don't care about people, or, well, you actually do, but it's difficult. It's either difficult to implement, or the guidelines themselves are flawed. So the paper we gave last year was pointing out some of the flaws in the WCAG guidelines and the flaws in the WAE model. So WCAG, so it says we have great content, great authoring tools and great browsers and everything will be wonderful. We don't have the great browsers. We have to work in a world in which, you know, various implementation is flawed. And that's after 6 years of WCAG. It hasn't worked. So there are some limitations there. One of the things about the WAE approach is it's based upon the notion of universal accessibility. And we feel this is flawed because we need universality for machine-to-machine specifications. But the whole thing about accessibility, it's about people. And people aren't universal. So there's the diversity in individuals. There's also the diversity in their environment, because there are cultural views of accessibility. So there is a social model of accessibility versus the medical model of accessibility, and there's also the context in which they're using. It's not just to access information, it can be learning, it can be culture, and so there's the subjectivity of that. So in terms of learning, you don't want the information provided in your face that you do with the map. What you want is the information, the knowledge happens here. And so to provide the answer is not what we do from a pedagogical approach. Similarly with culture, you know, we don't want Leonardo to have a caption saying Mona Lisa is smiling because ... There's a subjectivity of that. So there's a whole set of critique about, you know, we have published about the limitations of the way approach. The other side of things is, it's interesting that you're talking about we must do accessibility. How about we must do usability? And one of the dangers is that usability is being marginalised because there isn't the legal side of things and the, you know, sensitivities of those things. So the issue then becomes things like the use of Ajax. So I gave the example, you can move things and get dynamic responses because there's a clever bit of technology behind the scenes. If that makes things more usable for your users, is that a good thing? So there will be the need to look at some of the accessibility issues associated with some technologies, but we must not just dismiss them out of hand. And it's interesting, WCAG 2 guidelines are kind of downplaying some of the mistakes they made in version 1, which includes the issue about JavaScript.
Thank you, that's a good question. Could people who want to ask questions stand up and tell us who you are before you ask your question?
What happened to bots? I mean,
what happened to
bots? What happened to time bots?
They're very exciting. They're very exciting music programs like Music Balls. I can see them on the IKEA side doing, you know, exciting things. So
sorry, what's this on the IKEA side?
The balls are taking over within the balls, so that you don't get so much space. You get someone like Miss Boo doing the video, like the balls side doing all the talking. I'm just thinking.
So this is like an avatar which is talking to you.
Yes.
So I think the question is, what's happened to the bots? Yeah? So I think there, for me, there seem to be two different types of bots. One is the robot that's going around doing things and for you, and of course the bots in a way have taken over the world, because the Google bot is doing interesting things. The whole advertising issues, the Internet Archive is preserving websites, so their bots going down, and so their robots, automated software, which is managing data and managing and analysing relationships of data in order to provide richer services. And there was a whole set of discussions in that 6-page article about Google in yesterday's paper, which was talking about some of the positive side of things and some of the negative side of things. You know, and the fact that with eBay, when you register and you're buying something and you're talking to other people and you also bought something else, there are patterns that are being analysed similarly with that with Amazon. So I think some of those things are just there, and we think it's just the web these days. So I think a lot of that clever automated processing at the back end is now just there, and those things are happening. So there, I think some of the issues are that in some respects the data is not clean. So it can be difficult to make decisions, and need to be to apply some heuristics. The people who bought this might also have been interested in buying these things rather than the Hard Rock fan who got Britney Spears for the present for somebody else. But yeah, that clever processing of the back end data is happening.
Another question? A comment?
Yeah, surely they're in the work.
So perhaps a question, show of hands. Web 2.0, yeah, we've got to go. When you go back, you know, to your teams, to your work, you're going to say, yeah, we ought to be doing more of it, versus, no, it's just hype. We need to carry on with what we're doing. So Web 2.0.
All in favour.
All in favour.
Okay. Very shy.
But by the way, in case anybody didn't spot that, Susan's keen on Web 2.0, so if you're in the King's Web team. And are those who are saying no for whatever reasons, you know, I'm not going to ask?
No, nobody's
going to
put their decisions.
Well, which I think is fine, because I think we are in a period of, we need to absorb some of these technologies, we need to balance the hype versus the reality, we need in a way to analyse some of these things, we need to look at What are the easy wins? I'd say the Google Maps is a bit of an easy win, but in terms of developing Ajax interfaces, that might be more difficult to deploy for the various reasons you mentioned, and the legacy browsers, and the digital TV, and all of those things.
Stephen Evans, LSC. Just one comment there. I think you should let the users lead us on this.
Oh, was there a round of applause? Oh, you're getting the daggers looks. So, what do you mean by that? What would be different if the users like things rather than giving them out, or the normal?
I think there's always going to be an institutional perspective. There's always going to be the expert, there's always going to be the guru. But we should be regularly monitoring the needs of the users and asking what they want.
And
for
the value of IP net.
Sorry?
Hence the value of IP net and the user group, web user group for Susan. I mean, I'm interested in the political side of things, not just during any debate between the RD and ISS and other ways, but in your conferences, how are you engaging people like vice chancellors and directors of administration and finance, for example, in some of these discussions about where we go with our web services?
we have tried to target the MIS sector, for example, and we did have, who was it, it was someone local, it was a London college, somebody was on the programme committee from LSE.
Steve Bulley
was on the programme committee, because one of the things that we were keen on doing was getting more of the MIS people, because in a way they've got that, you know, relatively clean structured data, which has the capability of being used in interesting ways. But again, there is that sort of tension of the different cultures between, say, the academic community guys and the MIS guys. So we have tried to. I don't think we've necessarily cracked that.
Wouldn't crack the vice chancellor, but you had the guy from Royal Holloway.
We've had the vice chancellor at Canterbury.
That's right.
Gave a talk about his view, and we also had David Sweeney, who's now the principal
of Royal Holloway.
Again, spoken this year. So.
Because I think an interesting dimension, and I'm looking at my ERD colleagues here, is that the web obviously is a promotional tool for Kings to the world, and inevitably in higher education there's still a lot of competition, and we do have discussions about what other University of London colleges are doing with their website and how they might be promoting themselves or certain individuals a bit better than we are, or we're better than them. And sometimes the discussion focuses on the competition aspects rather than on the collaboration and competition, if you like, aspects of the web. So, you know, this mashup sort of technology that I think could actually bring some universities, particularly London, closer together and do some exciting things together is really something we need to explore. But we need our political masters bought into that, I think.
Tim Green, London School of Economics. I was interested in what you were saying about complexity of the new standards, because I think from a sort of support point of view, we produce a lot of just general support, little bits and pieces to go up on the web. One of the things that was nice about the early web was that it was all relatively easy to get your head around, relatively easy to do stuff. You pick up a standard tool that you already knew, you could pump out HTML, or you could produce a little bit of CGI, and things were straightforward. All this development of the standards, web services, and all the rest of it, while I fully support the need for standardization, if the standards get so complex that you can't actually get your head around them in enough time, you know, I spend a year and a half getting my head around a group of standards which will have gone out of date by the time I've done it, but I've still not delivered anything. So I think there's a big tension there on the standards and the pragmatic needs for development. I'm just wondering how you're seeing that shape out in the future.
Well, I would agree with you. The question is, there seems to be, in the early days, the web was kind of understandable. We could understand the client-server model, we could understand HTML, we could understand CSS, and we could just go out and do things and fit them into our processes. And now we've got a lot more complexity. We've got a lot of complexity at the machine-to-machine level. We've got complexity in understanding the models that the object has just built on. And we've got the shortage of skilled techies, particularly, I guess, in London, where there's a, you know, they get jobs for far more higher salary, you know, in the commercial sector. That was a real issue. It's one of the things I know sort of within a JISC environment, you know, was that the money available for developments, and then the institutions are saying, we've got the money, but where do we get the clever techies and make sure that they stay there? And it is difficult. I'm not saying it's not difficult. And I think in a way that was kind of interesting with the microformats approach, which was saying, here are some things that are easy to do. The model of doing things is relatively easy. Some of those things you can just do. I think that some of the other issues are, you don't need to understand what's going on, because there are applications which manage that for you. So one of the things about, there was a talk about why is nobody using the semantic web? We think it's great, but nobody seems to be using it. And some people say, well, it's actually embedded in things that you don't see at the back end. So for example, apparently in your HP laser printer or PostScript printer, the metadata for your PDF is encoded in RDF. So it's just things behind the scenes are using it. And if some of the big services like Yahoo have a great interest in semantic web technologies, if they're managing that, and they're providing that in some open way via, you know, there could be a link interface or some simple API interfaces, we don't need to have an understanding that we can exploit it. So we don't need to understand everything in a way, and nobody does. And that was the point that these clever people were saying, 1,000 pages of web services spec, anybody understand it? And, you know, there was nobody put their hand up at that session.
It's a good comment. Another comment from my colleague
back. I'm just going to make a point that's slightly countering the that the users like about it, perhaps half seriously. But one of the things I think is interesting about Web 2 is that it's changing the way stuff is developed and built as well as what's actually particularly in some areas of agile. And it seems to me that it opens up possibilities for building things so quickly. Have an idea, not something, you know, put it out there, try to survive. If you're a commercial company, try to survive without really making it for a period of time. And if it flies, people flock to the users, then you're in business. And it seems to me that we're almost at the stage where things are so easy to do that we can almost get away without needing some institutions. Well, have an idea. We have, all of us have service space, we have the, you know, the embarrassment of riches in terms of network and connectivity and so forth. We can put these things together and see if our users actually take to it. So we are letting the users decide, but not by asking them what they want, so much as giving them a palette of options, so they can choose just by not using them. I think there's this possible.
So I think that's kind of interesting. It's the, yeah, we do need to talk to users, but are the users feeding into our development process, or are the users the developers, or are the users the testers of the abilities of developers? And again, it's that role that, say, the web team or the institutional team or the institutional, perhaps I should say, the institutional web presence, which might be developed, but there's an organisational culture associated with that web presence, whether it's feeding through those various web teams in terms of user requirements, or it's feeding into the development process, and whether we're looking at things like the rapid developments and agile, and perhaps taking risks, versus feeding in to perhaps a more traditional development methodology, principle, etc., etc., which were some of the things that Stephen and I spoke about at last year's webinar. And we did say it might be interesting to have the rapid development versus traditional approach compared and contrasted.
XP
programming. XP programming. Yeah. So I would say that, you know, there are some of the issues and debates that are in play.
It's something we should be asking just to investigate and fund the research project. We've got time for a few more questions or comments if anyone would like to. Yes, there's one over there.
So, I mean, just wondering, podcasting is very much a sort of one-to-many type of thing. And it's especially to a large extent a one-to-one. Do you see it as sort of Web 2.0 equivalent to the old policy in the system for anyone who has a network that needs to get what we do?
Oh,
can you repeat that, Brian? Difficult to hear, I think.
What is the Web 2 equivalent of the kind of shared bulletin boards, shared area, loads and loads of social networking spaces? So Orkut, there's some interesting mashup environments. So there's a web browser called Flock. So you just install Flock and then you can get a view of the various feeds that you subscribe to. So that's an individual's view of, you know, a mashup. But then you might want to say, well, here's my mashup. I want other people to see my mashup. And there's something I subscribed to last week called, is it glue? Super glue? Anybody?
Super glue.
Super glue. So it's
I think
it's
the
E-O-G-O-V.
Super glue.
.com, and you register for that, and then you'll get a space, I believe. I've not tried it in any yet. But shared spaces, Wikipedia, that's a shared space by which you can all talk to things. Orkut, there's a shared social networking environment developed by Google. You know, there's just loads and loads of those things. Flickr has a shared space by which, you know, I can say, I like this guy's photos and subscribe and get RSS feeds for them. Delicious, shared space for sharing metadata about tags, etc., etc. I mean, that's core to the whole philosophy of Web 2.0. SourceForge, you know, ways in which the software, open source software developers can get together and other people in the community.
Great. Well, I'm going to bring this to a close now, but I know that Brian can stay on a little bit longer. We've got the room for two. So if individuals want to come up and have a chat with Brian, you're welcome to do so. Can I ask you all, before you go,